They overflew the vessel and observed a light sheen coming from the stern of the vessel.
A fishing tender capsizes near a productive salmon stream in Bristol Bay. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, July 1st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, state employees protest new workspaces designed to save money.
I can retire tomorrow, and it might be my option if this kind of comes about without any input from us.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
A large response effort is underway to deal with a Trident Seafoods fishing tender that sank Sunday morning near the mouth of one of the major salmon-producing rivers in Bristol Bay. KDLG's Mike Mason has the details.
The 78-foot tender Lone Star is currently sitting nearly upside down near the mouth of the Agushik River on the west side of the Nooshigak Commercial Fishing District. A unified command has been created to deal with the sunken tender, and a large response effort is getting organized. John Brown is with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. He confirms that an overflight of the sunken tender was conducted Monday morning.
They overflew the vessel and observed a light sheen coming from the stern of the vessel that was about 300 foot by 20 foot. It was a broken silver sheen, and it was determined that it wasn't really recoverable. But what they're going to be doing this evening is loading up a bunch of absorbent sausage boom and taking it out the vessel and trying to catch any of that sheen that's coming off the vessel.
The Lone Star is apparently sitting in about 18 feet of water and is bowed down with the stern exposed. Brown admits the area is very tidally influenced, and it's unclear if boom will actually be effective.
We recognize that the currents are too strong for anchoring boom. This will actually be just basically probably just tied off to the stern of the vessel on each side, just trying to catch any of that sheen that might be coming off there.
At the time of the sinking, the Lone Star had about 14,000 gallons of diesel fuel on board, along with 250 gallons of unleaded gasoline. The vessel also held about 150 gallons of hydraulic oil and 150 gallons of lubricating oils. Brown confirms the U.S. Coast Guard has contracted Magone Marine Services to remove the petroleum products off the Lone Star. Brown notes that the company is bringing in divers and diving equipment that should allow a closer look at the Lone Star.
Our hope is here in the immediate near future, possibly tomorrow night's tide if we're lucky, but we're looking possibly more at Wednesday's low tide in the evening, of plugging the vents and keeping the fuel inside of the vessel.
The cause of the sinking of the Lone Star will be investigated by the Coast Guard, but the crew on board reported that when the tide changed, the anchor line struck the transducer, which caused damage to the vessel's hull. The vessel then began taking on water. A Good Samaritan vessel picked up the four crew members on board the Lone Star before it sank, and they are all safe and sound. Shortly after the vessel sank, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game closed the commercial set net fishery in the area and instituted a large closed area for the drifters. Those closures have since been rescinded, and everyone is apparently back to fishing as normal. So far, there have been no reports of contaminated fish or waterfowl. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Every 10 years, Alaska's political lines are redrawn to reflect changes in population. In an ideal world, the state's redistricting board takes the results of the U.S. Census, tries to divide the state into regions with equal population, and finalizes a map before the next election cycle. That didn't happen this go-round. It's been nearly 3 years since the redistricting board first came together, and Alaska still doesn't have its political boundaries settled. Last month, the redistricting board offered yet another set of maps for review, and they're now taking testimony on their plans in Alaska's major cities. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez was at the Fairbanks meeting, and she's here to talk with us today. Hello, Alexandra.
Hi, Lori.
How did we get to this point?
Well, as you mentioned, it's been a long process. For decades, the redistricting board has had to follow two sets of guidelines. On the state level, the Hickel process, which was named for former Governor Wally Hickel, requires the board to follow the Alaska state constitution and create districts that are compact, share cultural and economic interests, and aren't being broken up into funny shapes. Then, at the federal level, the state was required by the Voting Rights Act to make sure that Alaska Natives maintained a certain level of political influence. What the board did was follow the federal guidelines first. The courts ruled that approach was unconstitutional, and what we were left with was a temporary map for last year's elections and a redistricting board that was told to start the process over.
So, Alexandra, what options are before the redistricting board now?
There's kind of a mess of them. The redistricting board offered 7 of their own plans, and on top of that, a group in Fairbanks that initially sued over redistricting offered a map. So did the Ketchikan Gateway Borough. So did a Republican group, which also offered another revision. And we also saw 3 different versions of a map from Chulista. All of that has left the public kind of confused as to what their districts will look like and who their elected officials might be. At the meeting in Fairbanks today, a number of people testifying complained that they hardly knew which map to comment on because there were just so many options, and they can all get a little bit complicated. I mean, we're talking maps of the whole state here, divided at the neighborhood level.
How does last week's U.S. Supreme Court decision overriding some of the Voting Rights Act affect this process?
It affects it in a couple of major ways. For one, it closes the option of the board saying they need to go back to their maps to see if they have the required number of strong Native districts. So it could speed up the process a little in that regard. One interesting thing I've heard about that from operatives is that because Native districts tend to elect Democrats, the loss of the Voting Rights Act protection could potentially benefit them this cycle. Last go round, a lot of Fairbanks Democrats were included in rural districts because of that requirement, and that triggered a lot of cries of gerrymandering after 2 Fairbanks Democrats lost their seats. Today, we heard a lot of concerns about that, especially regarding communities near Fairbanks like Esther and Goldstream. They don't want to be paired with rural districts because they don't have that much in common. We also heard about Native villages that tend to be against development being reluctant to be matched with more pro-development villages. For example, Arctic Village doesn't really want to be grouped in with North Slope communities.
Alexandra, where does this leave us now?
With so many maps on the table, it's hard to say what map we'll get. We could get a sort of Frankenstein map that takes bits and pieces from the redistricting board plans and some of the third-party options, too. But no matter what map we get, it's not going to please everyone. This is a very, very political process where there are winners and losers. And what we're going to see potentially is some of these unhappy people thinking about maybe taking this to court again. After the board meeting today, I even heard a couple of people saying they wanted to get all of their grievances out on the record at this meeting. So if they do go to the courts, they've got that. So it's possible that the end might not be in sight.
All right. Thanks for joining us and giving us that update, Alexandra.
My pleasure.
That was APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez speaking with us today from Fairbanks. Interest rates for subsidized Stafford loans double today. The increase affects all future loans, but Congress could intervene and fix the problem. If it does not, students across the country could see higher interest rates come graduation. APRN's Peter Granitz reports.
Congress has known for years this day was coming, but both the House and Senate got out of town last week for the 4th of July holiday without reaching an agreement on student loan rates. As of today, the rate for all future subsidized Stafford loans is 6.8%. That's for incoming freshmen, as well as sophomores, juniors, and seniors, anyone who will take out one of these loans.
There's no question that every time they make a move like this, it just gets harder.
John Pugh is the chancellor of the University of Alaska Southeast. He says his school has done a good job educating future students about taking on too much debt. Counselors encourage incoming freshmen to utilize all types of financing available, especially Pell Grants. But those options are not available to everyone. He says the typical student who gets subsidized Stafford loans is often the first in the family to attend college.
And they're the most vulnerable for not understanding, they and their families not really understanding the financing of higher ed.
The federal government pays the interest on the subsidized loans while a student is still in school. Congress sets the rate at which students borrow and is willing to cede that power. Both the president and House Republicans want to peg the new rates to the 10-year Treasury note. That's the rate the government borrows at. But many Senate Democrats, led by Education Committee Chairman Tom Harkin, don't like the idea. Beth Akers is an education expert at the Brookings Institution.
We're creating this debate year after year without really any gain.
And that's why many hope Congress can permanently fix the problem. The president's plan would lock in interest rates for the life of the loan, and the GOP version would reevaluate the rate every May. For all the doomsday scenarios, Akers says the change is not as severe as it sounds.
We're talking about this doubling of interest rates in a way that makes it sound like a really catastrophic thing has happened. But the reality is that 3.4 to 6.8 percentage points for a borrower who's borrowing the maximum amount of federal aid available to them is about $40 a month. And that's on about a $300 payment.
There's an option many are floating. When Congress returns next week, it could pass a fix and then retroactively enforce it. And there's another one, one that may be more likely. Congress could do what it did last year, pass a one-year extension of the 3.4% rate, and have this fight again next summer. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, ADAC city manager takes a big gamble on the community's future.
So that we, you know, that we have an economic future, which is based in fisheries. Everything here is related to fisheries.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
As an active senior, your independence is important to you. One of the ways for you to maintain your independence is to reduce your risk of falling. A fall risk assessment can be part of your initial or annual Medicare exam. They'll ask about your vision and review your medications for possible problems. Learn ways to improve balance, strengthen muscles, and reduce hazards at home. Contact your Medicare provider for an appointment. This message in Good Health is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The state of Alaska is implementing new work areas in Juneau and Anchorage office buildings. Officials claim new universal space standards will save money and create a better work environment, but some state employees think otherwise. KTOO's Lisa Fu has the story.
Dylan Ray Fournier works on the Southeast Alaska Bat Monitoring Project.
Passive detectors that turn on at night and record the bat's echolocation.
Ray Fournier works for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in the Douglas Building. His workspace isn't your typical office. Shelves are stacked to the ceiling with equipment like bat detectors, battery boxes, solar panels. A metal locker has laptops and climate recorders. Rain gear hangs from various hooks. He's also in charge of making sure the equipment works in all types of weather, which takes more stuff.
Yep, hardware, you know, it's kind of a little workshop here.
All of this fits into a 9-by-10-foot workspace, but the state wants to put Ray Fournier and his equipment into a 6-by-8 cubicle, reducing his work area by about half. Universal space standards impose guidelines on who gets an office and who doesn't. Senior management and administrative positions like attorneys or physicians get an office. Those below get 6-by-8-foot cubicles or workstations grouped into neighborhoods. The standards also dictate the type and color of the workstation furniture.
A cherry wood finish.
Deputy Administration Commissioner Curtis Thayer says Capitol Office won the bid to supply the new office furnishings, with the average cost of installing a new cubicle at $6,500. Thayer says the space standards will save the state $125 million over the next 10 to 20 years, beginning with the Robert Atwood Building in Anchorage and state office buildings in Nome, Juneau, and Douglas. For example, in the Atwood Building,
they're actually going to be able to have 97 bodies on a floor where previously they had 60.
He says enough space will be freed up to lease to other government agencies, which are paying higher rent in the private sector.
Cards, cables, microphones, all these little...
Work areas filled with gear are more the norm in the Douglas Building. Firearms, darting guns, tracking equipment.
We're not an office where you come in and sit down and look at a computer all day and maybe have a couple file drawers.
Fisheries tech Iris Frank spends most of her time analyzing sockeye fish scales. She wonders how space standards will go with the fish and game model.
One size does not fit all. It was kind of a draconian way how it came about. We were just told there was no input from the employees. And if there had been, maybe we could have come up with some suggestions that might have helped facilitate our needs and the administration's needs.
Frank has been with Fish and Game since 1977 and is planning on retiring in 2 years.
I can retire tomorrow, and it might be my option if this kind of comes about without any input from us.
Employee retention and recruitment are big issues for the state of Alaska. Health and Human Services Program Manager Robert Sewell says putting everyone in cubicles is not the right move.
There are huge costs to turnover in terms of recruitment, in terms of loss of institutional memory, in terms of disruption of customer or client contact.
Thayer says moving people into cubicles means more conference and break rooms, as well as private telephone booths, better ventilation, and the right to light. He cites the banking and securities division in the Atwood building.
They went from all private offices into an open work environment, into what we call pods of four employees. You go up there now, they do not want to go back to their offices. They'll say, this is better, we have more light, we talk to each other, we collaborate with each other.
Thayer says the state's move to an open work environment is behind the times, and other agencies have already made the shift.
General services for the federal government have gone to an open work environment. The NANA building, BP, has gone to the open work environment.
With new space standards, Thayer says NOME offices will have more conference rooms, and Douglas will be able to house an additional 20 employees.
We're trying to save money. And if we can't do it in space, it comes out of programs. And if we take money out of programs, it could come out of employees.
New workstations are being installed on the 7th floor in Juneau State Office Building, commonly known as the SOB. The official unveiling is July 17th. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Governor Sean Parnell signed into law a bill last week that will put $35 million toward construction of residential housing in Anchorage with a sky bridge to the Alaska Native Medical Center. A move supporters say will save the state millions of dollars each year. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes reports.
The state is putting $35 million toward construction of a 170-bed residential facility with sky bridge access to the Alaska Native Medical Center, or ANMC. The sponsor of Senate Bill 88 is Fairbanks Republican Pete Kelly, co-chair of the Senate Finance Committee. He says at first he was skeptical about the project.
But this, I think, is one of the rare times in government where spending some money now is actually going to save us some money. And we'll see returns on this, I think, year after next when the facility is finally up and operational.
Kelly says the project will stem the constantly growing cost to the state of Medicaid.
What it does is it allows for the federal government to pay for 100% of the medical costs rather than the 50% that are paid at other facilities. As a result, it allows the state to save somewhere in the neighborhood of about $8.5 million per year. So it should be a pretty good project.
Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium CEO Roald Helgeson says the housing is needed for people who are getting chemotherapy, pregnant women with complications waiting to deliver, and others who need to be near the medical center but don't need to be admitted.
More than 58% of our patients from across Alaska come into the Alaska Native Medical Center, and they need a place to stay while they're here. For us, it's an issue of access to care, and without housing, our patients won't have that access to important health services.
Helgeson says the housing will bring more patients to ANMC, bringing some of the health care dollars that now go to the Providence and Alaska Regional Medical Centers to the consortium, which he says will take money now going into living expenses and put it into health care.
Services that we're looking at expanding include our maternal child health and our neonatal intensive care unit. We're looking at expansion in our operating suites as well as endoscopy. Our advanced imaging, and several of our additional specialty services like ophthalmology, ear, nose, and throat, urology, and some of our services that are critical on an ongoing basis, such as the intensive care unit, emergency services.
In a prepared statement, Anchorage Republican Senator Kevin Meyer, who supported the bill, said the community atmosphere of the facility will bring cultural values into the recovery process. The state will sell bonds to finance construction, which is expected to be completed in 2 years. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of Native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at the AlaskaNanookCommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources.
A house fire in the Yukon River village of Nunum Iqua killed three people over the weekend and injured others. KYUK Sophie Ivan reports.
The fire broke out in the three-bedroom home during a party that lasted into the morning hours. Alaska State Troopers have been investigating and say the fire started around 6:30 Friday morning. Trooper spokesperson Beth Ibsen says the three people who died have yet to be positively identified by the state medical examiner, so they haven't released any names yet.
Residents, they actually try to put the fire out, and they did eventually, but not without doing a considerable amount of damage. They tried with buckets of water and then hoses, like lawn hoses, and they eventually put the fire out, but not before three people died in the fire.
Two other people were medevaced from the village for smoke inhalation and minor burns. They were flown into Bethel before being sent on to Anchorage for further treatment. Ibsen says 14 people were in the home partying when the fire started near the door, which prevented them from exiting.
There's a mixture of ages of the people. Some were awake, some were sleeping. The fire broke out near the entrance of the home, meaning the door, so they couldn't get out through the front door, and they had to escape through a window. So 14 people trying to make a mad scramble through a window to escape a fire. As you can imagine, it was pretty chaotic.
A trooper from St. Mary's and a deputy fire marshal from Anchorage spent the weekend at the scene of the fatal fire trying to determine the cause, which Ibsen says is still unknown. The village of Nunum Iqua is located at the mouth of the Yukon River. In Bethel, I'm Sophie Ivan.
About 150 people marched on Saturday in Anchorage from Town Square to a powwow at Delaney Park Strip in support of the Fairbanks Four. Those are the four Alaska Native or American Indian men convicted in 1999 of murdering teenager John Hartman in Fairbanks. KMBA's Bethany Brunel has the story.
In 1997, 15-year-old John Hartman was found alive but brutally beaten on a cold October day in Fairbanks. He lived long enough for his mother to say goodbye. Four men, Marvin Roberts, George Freese, Eugene Vent, and Kevin Pease, were charged and convicted of the crime. Rally organizer April Monroe Frick, who grew up with the four, says they were young, in their late teens and 20s, and had no history of violence.
This was a brutal, brutal, bloody, stomping murder. None of these four men had ever exhibited any behavior that would indicate they would commit a crime of this nature.
Hazel Roberts' son Marvin was one of the four.
I knew right from the start that my son was innocent. He wasn't the type to do something like this, and he was a valedictorian of his high school class. He got the principal's award of the year. He was just a good kid.
Alaska Innocence Project Executive Director Bill Overly says the four had never met Hartman, and police and prosecutors had little to support their case.
The deeper we get into the case, the more we believe that they are innocent. The assault on John Hartman, there was no one at the scene, so there are no eyewitnesses. There was no physical evidence collected at the scene.
Sentences for the four range from 33 to 79 years. They've been serving their time in a Colorado correctional facility far from family members and friends who might have visited them. Recently, two were transferred to Alaska prisons. I'm Bethany Brunel.
The city of Adak and the Adak Community Development Corporation bought $2 million worth of fish processing equipment at auction last month. Now, as KUCB's Stephanie Joyce reports, they're looking for someone to operate it.
The equipment was up for sale because Icicle Seafoods pulled out of Adak earlier this year. City Manager Leighton Lockett says in an ideal world, another seafood processor would have swooped in and bought it up. Instead, the apparent high bid was from a scrapper that wanted the equipment for parts. So Lockett stepped in.
Last few seconds, I made the decision to do it.
The purchase was a big gamble for the 12-year-old city. Even with a $385,000 contribution from the ADAC Community Development Corporation, it pretty much wiped out the municipality's reserves. But Lockett sees it as a necessary investment.
So that we, you know, that we have an economic future, which is based in fisheries. Everything here is related to fisheries.
The city's economic future doesn't just depend on the equipment, though. It depends on that equipment processing fish, and the city has no interest in doing that. Instead, it's looking for a seafood processing company to take over the venture.
The number one goal is to get it operating again. So if you know, a processor wants to buy it, great. Absolutely. If they want to lease it, we need to discuss it, just like we would need to discuss, you know, purchase. But the idea is to keep it open.
Complicating matters is the fact the equipment is housed in a building owned by Aleut Enterprise, a subsidiary of the Aleut Corporation. Any potential operator would need to work out a deal with them as well. Nevertheless, Lockett is optimistic that the plant will be up and running by next January. He says a few companies have already made inquiries.
I mean, I can't mention who they are at this point, but we've gotten a few. And I mean, if they want to mention it, great.
For now, there's no rush. The city is operating within its budget, and Lockett says there won't be any cuts resulting from the equipment purchase. But in a typical year, the city derives 30 to 40% of its revenues from fisheries taxes. And now that the reserve has been spent, the pressure is on to reopen the plant and get ADAC back in business. In Unalaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
History was repeated last Friday when the Centennial Denali Expedition reached the summit of North America's highest peak. The summit team is made up of five men representing the first party to reach the summit of Denali, as well as four guides from the Alaska Mountaineering School. The team reached the summit on Friday evening, and they are currently descending the mountain. Unlike most climbers who fly in and out of base camp on the Kahiltna Glacier, the team will be walking out of the Alaska Range and across 22 miles of tundra to the Park Road before being picked up. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Mike Mason in Dillingham, Jacqueline Estes and Bethany Brunel in Anchorage, Lisa Fu in Juneau, Sophie Ivan in Bethel, Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, and Philip Manning in Talkeetna. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Fairbanks and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
How do you get men to wear a life jacket when the fact is that 90% of those who die in boating accidents in Alaska are men? Well, most men won't listen to this message, but they might listen to you. So have them pledge to wear a life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. That's pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back home. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.